Our third speaker this morning is Dr. Rosanna Scutella, and she's a senior research fellow at the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research at the University of Melbourne. And she's currently involved in research on homelessness in Australia, social exclusion, and the employment retention and advancement of disadvantaged job seekers. Rosanna. Rosanna also informed me that she's an economist, even though Peter earlier said that the economists were being left all this afternoon.
Well, I guess technically it is after lunch, so it's 12 o'clock, so it is afternoon, I guess. So, yes, I was going to come up and confess to being an economist. So I'm not sure how that affects the kind of balance of the day. Firstly, I'd like to thank Peter and Sheila and Susan for inviting me to take part in today. I'm really honoured to be here to talk about my work. So what I'm going to be focusing on discussing today is an aspect of inequality a little different to what has been discussed earlier about income inequality, and I'm very much focused on the inequality of opportunity. Most of us take for granted that we will enjoy, you know, most of the other opportunities that other people have, to have a job, to get an education, if we need help. We have family members that we can rely on to support us, or friends to support us. If we want to participate in our communities, we can participate in our communities. But not everybody enjoys these same opportunities. Those that don't enjoy these opportunities are those that you can think of as being excluded from society. So in this presentation, I'm very much wanting to look at what the extent of this exclusion is in Australia, what the recent trends have been on exclusion rates, and on what groups within the population are those most exposed to exclusion. And this is work that started quite a while ago when I was still at the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, around 5 or 6 years ago. It began with a collaboration between the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence and the Melbourne Institute, in particular with my colleague Roger Wilkins at the Institute and Michael Horn and Paul Smythe at the Brotherhood. And Wei-Ping Kostenko was involved in early work here, and more recently with Francisco Aspetate, who is the current Ronald Henderson Research Fellow at the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence and at the Melbourne Institute, a joint position between the two. So what exactly is social exclusion? So the concept originated back in the 1970s in France, and it referred to quite a narrow kind of concept of what exclusion is, in that it referred to the population that was unprotected by the French social security system. The concept has since been taken up by most European countries and the European Union. In the recent Australian government, under the Labor government, it was taken up here in Australia. There was a social inclusion unit that was developed within Prime Minister and Cabinet. But it's since lost favour with the Conservative governments in the UK and in Australia. But it's still very much a focus in the European Union, and it's a very important element of their 2020 strategy, Europe 2020 strategy. And more recently, it's referring to a range of dimensions which marginalise people and reduce their opportunities to engage in social, economic and political life. So it's taken on a little bit of a broader kind of definition than what it initially was. It's inherently multidimensional. It's the focus is not so much on whether people have kind of one dimension of disadvantage. It's very much about the intersection of these disadvantages and how these disadvantages kind of reinforce each other. So it's important to take account of this multidimensionality when you're looking at measuring or identifying who is excluded from society. And there's been a lot of work done. Peter Saunders has been involved in doing some of this work in Australia that have looked at developing measures of exclusion. And most of these studies will use data that look at various dimensions such as material resources, labour market outcomes, education, health, social interactions, community participation, and personal safety. So in the work that we've done, how do we measure social exclusion? We were influenced by the range of studies that have been done in this area, but we particularly follow Tanya Burkhard's work and a paper by her in 2000, and focus on measures that capture participation or the ability to participate in all aspects of society. We capture exclusion at the individual level, which enables us to examine who experiences multiple dimensions of exclusion and also the persistence of exclusion over time. Now, no data set is perfect for these things because there's a range of different indicators of exclusion or disadvantage that we want to look at, and also we want to look at who experiences these things over time. So even though there are issues with the HILDA data set, this seemed to be the most apt data set for our needs, so we use HILDA in our. Now, in the next two slides, I present the indicators of social exclusion that we use to construct our measure. I'm not going to go over this in line by line in much detail, but I just wanted to put this up to show that we include seven domains of exclusion, and we have a range of different indicators for each of these domains. And then we present here in the third column there, the average incidence of exclusion on that indicator over the period 2001 to 2011. And you can see that the incidence of each of the indicators varies considerably from long-term unemployment, for example, number five, where there's an average incidence of 0.4% of the population aged 15 years and above, to around 36 of the population that have low household net worth. Again, with the remaining four domains, we have a range of different indicators of exclusion that we look at. And again, the incidence varies considerably across the indicators. So how do we actually account for the multidimensionality to get an aggregate measure? We're going to do that, we need to weight each of the various domains, and we need to weight each of the various indicators within each of the domains as well. And this is always very controversial because this requires someone imposing value on each of the different domains. And there's no right or wrong way of doing this. Some suggest that you should ask people what they think is important. There are problems with this approach, in addition to problems with just using, you know, straight let the data rule type approach as well. So no approach is perfect. So we take the approach of assigning equal weight to each domain, and where the value is inversely related to the number of indicators within each domain. So then you end up with a number which ranges between 0 and 1 for each domain. You sum across these numbers, which we call the sum of scores, and this identifies the overall extent of exclusion of each individual. And this ranges between the values of 0 and 7. Then we make an arbitrary kind of decision about where our thresholds lie, and we define that anyone that has a score equal to above 1 is at least marginally excluded, and anyone that has a score above or equal to 2 is deeply excluded. And this is what we get. So here presented the rates of both income poverty rates and the measured social exclusion rates in Australia from 2001 to 2011. So the top line refers to the rate of people who are at least marginally excluded. The bottom line refers to those that are deeply excluded. And the line in the middle is the income poverty rate, so relative income poverty rate, using a poverty threshold of 60% of equivalized household income. And you can see that over this period, the rates of both marginal exclusion and deep exclusion kind of gradually went down. How do I use this pointer? Right there. So the rates kind of were decreasing up until about 2007. About 2007, 2008, when the global financial crisis hit and an economic slowdown. And even, I mean, the scale is smaller here, but there was also a slight decline in the rates of deep exclusion. But the rate of relative income poverty didn't really change that much over that period. And then after the global financial crisis hit, you see that rates of marginal exclusion increased a little. And the rates of deep exclusion, I mean, that looks flat. They did increase slightly around here, and they've remained at levels that were roughly at those that were at 2006. So they're no longer trending downwards. So here present the social exclusion rates by gender. And you can see the top two lines are those at least marginally excluded. The bottom two lines are those deeply excluded. The purple lines refer to women, to females, and the orange to males. And you can see that women face greater levels of social exclusion, whether it's marginal exclusion or deep exclusion, than males. But the trends by gender are kind of similar. So here you can see the rates of deep exclusion only by people of particular age categories. So I don't present the marginal exclusion rates just because there were too many categories and things get messy. And arguably it's those that are deeply excluded that we care about the most. So you can see that the top line are those that are aged 65 years plus, and they have the highest rates of deep exclusion. But the differences aren't huge, and the differences definitely aren't as large as if you compare income poverty rates across the different age groups. Oh, sorry, let me go back. Things to say. And you can also see that the groups that were most affected by the economic downturn and the global financial crisis were both the eldest and it's the youngest here, those aged 15 to 24 years here, who faced an increase in their rates of deep exclusion. So that's particularly worrying. And then here you can see that those with long-term illnesses or disabilities have much higher rates of exclusion, whether it's marginal exclusion or deep exclusion, than other Australians. And Indigenous exclusion is significantly higher than that of the rest of the population. And almost twice as high than the rest of the population. So the Indigenous exclusion rates are presented in orange on this graph. What's perhaps most worrying is that the exclusion rates have been increasing since 2008. Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders using this measure. Public housing tenants are significantly more likely to be deeply excluded than people in any other form of housing tenure. And they were particularly hit by the financial crisis here and the economic slowdown. And that's continuing to rise, so that is really troubling. And by education level, deep exclusion rates, those that haven't completed secondary school, regardless of whether they have a Certificate 1 or Certificate 2 level qualification, are the most likely to be deeply excluded in Australian society. And there's a lot of jumping around here just because sample sizes are starting to get a little small here. And I think this is the final one. By household type, you can see that single people, whether with children or without children, they're the top two lines, have the highest rates of deep exclusion. The purple line refers to single parents. And you can see here that deep exclusion rates for single parents started increasing around 2006. So that was before the global financial crisis. That's when the welfare reforms came in. So it looks like that their rates of deep exclusion have risen as a result of that. And then for single people without children, it's kind of slightly risen after the global financial crisis again. Okay, so here I've just been presenting rates of the excluded using an arbitrary kind of threshold to determine who's excluded and who isn't. But what is in particular really interesting to look at is to see whether those that are excluded are actually different to those that are poor using an income poverty measure. And because we're just using arbitrary thresholds to determine who is excluded, it might not be relevant to just compare who we identify as excluded using those thresholds with those who are identified as poor using a relative income poverty threshold. So what we do is we rank people and then we look at who's in the bottom 20% based on either measure. So who's the worst off using either the excluded measure or an income poverty measure, or using income, sorry, no poverty there. And we do find that they're different. We find that there are, even though person 65 years or over do seem to be the largest group within the excluded, within the bottom 20% using the excluded measure, they are a much smaller share than an income measure would identify. And we also identify more families with children to be excluded than an income measure would identify. And we also find that the most excluded group captures a larger share of persons with a long-term health condition. In more recent work that is still very much work in progress, we've been looking at trying to identify whether our social exclusion measure is a better measure at capturing those that are chronically poor, so those that have low incomes or low resources over time. And we have actually found that our measure reflects the chronic poor better when that measure also takes wealth into account. So not just income, but also takes into account the wealth that households hold. So it does seem to be a measure that is better capturing those most disadvantaged in society. And in concluding, I just wanted to say that it's essential to have good measures of poverty and social exclusion to understand the extent of the problem, to monitor trends over time, and also to enable policy to target the right people, I guess, or at least to identify who they should be looking at if you think that a policy is going to have an impact on a particular group. Social exclusion is inherently a multidimensional concept, So it's important to measure this at the individual level, which allows you to identify the extent of exclusion that people face at a particular point in time and also over time. We found that those excluded are not necessarily all poor when you look at their incomes, and those poor are not necessarily all excluded. And our measure looks like it identifies the chronic poor better if you take into account a broader concept of resources that includes wealth as well as incomes. And thank you.
Bob Stimson, University of Melbourne. I think we're getting a good illustration here of the real value you can get out of these longitudinal data sets, large surveys. But it opens up big opportunities for secondary data analysis, which is probably something that's not undertaken as seriously as it could be in Australia compared to, say, the US. And it seems to me that there are three things that could be looked at more extensively with this data. First of all, have people been using factor and analytic techniques to look at the way in which you can get summary dimensions that explain most of the variance across these various measures of social exclusion? Secondly, are people working on developing typologies of households and individuals? Thirdly, it seems to me that there's a great opportunity to use structural equation modelling to look at what the linked up type of mediating effects are of the particular variables you've got in your data to look at, what are the key determinants of the linkages, the pathways in terms of mediating effects that can occur in the data, which has not been undertaken in the analysis so far. So I think there's a great opportunity for a very much deeper and richer exploration of these data.
And thank you for those suggestions. I'll just comment on each of them, I guess, briefly. We have used a variant of kind of factor analysis in checking for the sensitivity of our results. We've used what's it called now? I've drawn a blank. It'll come to me later. But what we found is that because we're using an arbitrary kind of threshold to determine who's excluded and who isn't, then obviously using that technique will change the proportion of people that fall below the category. But if you look at the ranking of people, it doesn't seem to lead to much of a difference. On the typologies, we haven't looked at using cluster analysis, I guess, is what you're suggesting, to group people into different groups based on the similarities of their characteristics. But we could do that. I have done some work using that same analysis to group people based on people's experiences of homelessness in another project that I'm working on, but not on this one. And I fully agree that it would be great to use structural equation modelling to start looking at the timing of each of these things. Obviously, when you're doing that, the longer you observe people for, the better, because then you can actually see what's kind of leading to what in what time period. It would be great to do further analysis.
Thanks for your presentation, Rosanna. We've done a lot of work on social exclusion with Jenny Poppe in the UK, who headed the Knowledge Network for the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health. And she argues very strongly that our research effort shouldn't be on those who are excluded, but on the exclusionary processes. and that we can describe the disadvantage, you know, and always public housing, you know, families with children come up however we do it. But really we need a research effort on what are the processes that cause that exclusion, because that isn't a characteristic of those individuals, that's a characteristic of the society. And in the European Review of Health Inequities that's just been published, they've adopted that perspective very strongly, and I'm just interested in your comments on that.
I agree that it's important to understand the exclusionary process, and I guess that's what structural equation modelling would start kind of helping out with. But I also think it's important to identify who's the most disadvantaged as well, and to keep track of that to see whether things are getting worse or better over time, whether they're associated with particular policy changes, how they change with business cycle changes and things like that. So, yes, I agree it's important to look at the process, but not without looking at developing good measures of who's disadvantaged as well. And there's a fly buzzing around here that's a bit distracting.
Thank you very much. John Nievenhausen said to me, and I agree thoroughly, the spirit of Ronald Henderson lives on in the Institute. Just a quick question. You mentioned that your measures were arbitrary, that's inevitable, but did you do a systematic sensitivity test to see how they varied when you changed the weights?
We did some sensitivity analysis to look at what happens when we change the weights. I wouldn't say it was systematic. We looked at how a data-driven approach using its item response theory that we used would have how that impacts on our findings and who's most disadvantaged and who isn't. We also just looked at varying the weights of some of our economic resource categories and lessening the weights of others. It doesn't seem to make much of a difference to the way people are ranked. Obviously, at the extremes, if you only included one particular measure and didn't include any of the others, that's going to have an impact. We're doing some further analysis to look at the sensitivity.
Was the French social security system an exclusion? And that was a very good logical way through it all. So I'm going to ask you a further question that's not in that. That is, how do these so-called objective measures relate to people's experience, subjective sense? Am I excluded? From whom and in what way?
So we have a range of objective and subjective measures in our indicators of exclusion. We could also compare with the way that we've compared our social exclusion measure with an income measure. We could compare it with other subjective measures of life satisfaction or happiness, say, to see how they're related. We haven't looked at that. That's a good question, actually.
The reference to Ronald Henderson is pertinent here. Of course, your institute in particular, but has been looking at issues of, and others, poverty over many years. So we know actually quite a lot about who are the poor and some of the processes that generate that. So I'd just be interested in your summary of what you found through using the social exclusion that surprised you, that we kind of didn't already know. To tell us that Indigenous, single parents, people in public housing, ill health, particularly social exclusion, doesn't add a great deal. Like what you've done is to quantify it carefully and to show how it's changed over time, and that's valuable. Were you surprised by anything?
I was surprised by a few things. I wasn't so surprised at who was identified as being most excluded. I was surprised at the extent of the difference for particular groups, so public housing residents, for example. For those with low educations, I was surprised that those with a certificate level 1 or 2 level of education were as excluded as those who didn't have that extra qualification. And I was also surprised at the trend, I guess, over time, that it did seem to be reducing from the period 2001 to 2007, and then was quite sensitive to the business cycle effect after 2007, 2008.
Compare the severity of exclusion, i.e. a score, a mean score, or the number of indicators on which someone is excluded by a number of objective well-being measures, find a consistent decline, i.e. The more severe you are excluded, the lower subjective well-being on happiness scales, on life satisfaction scales, satisfaction with your financial situation scales. Even more interesting, that those relationships are stronger than the relationships between income, poverty, objective well-being, which I must say surprised me, but later I've...
Just for people who don't know about it, Peter's hardship measures are a good middle ground in these.
Sorry, even though you used a microphone, I couldn't hear you, Hal.
Well, having grabbed the floor, I'll just say that I think the hardship measures that you developed in the past are quite good for a middle level between the objective, more social indicator approach that we've seen today and the more subjective quality of life global sorts of measures, and that they are very good in relating to standards of living, which is where the objective can make a difference for people's lives.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Rosella said that your indicators include both objective and there are objective and subjective indicators in them.
I mean, there are more objective indicators than subjective, but we do have some subjective indicators in there. Remember what they were. Yeah, there probably aren't that many.
Okay, I think we should thank Rosanna very much for a very interesting talk. And I'd also like to thank the other two speakers. I think it was a very interesting session. Thank you both.